KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says his tariffs of foreign cars will bring back American manufacturing. We speak with a Texas mayor in a town with a GM plant. Will tariffs make things better for those workers? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Democratic voters are taking out some of their anger on Democrats in Congress. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez, they say they're not fighting hard enough against the Trump administration, and some are challenging incumbents. Also studying a constitutional sleeping giant, the 14th Amendment, and Branford Marcellus on bringing a New Orleans perspective to a jazz classic. It's Friday, March 28th. Today in 1964, a pirate radio station launched on a literal boat, giving UK listeners their pop music fix when the BBC would not. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Vice President Vance and his wife, Usha, are on their way to Greenland. The island is an autonomous territory of Denmark that President Trump says he wants to get. NPR's Tamara Keith reports that Vance's trip is quite different from what was originally described.
Initially, it was announced that Second Lady Usha Vance and her son would attend Greenland's national dog sled race and other cultural excursions. But it was received by Greenland as a provocative and unwelcome move. After significant blowback, Vice President J.D. Vance announced he'd be joining too, and the visit would be restricted to a U.S. Space Force base, where the VP will receive briefings and deliver remarks to U.S. service members. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz is also joining. The idea of a U.S. takeover is deeply unpopular in Greenland, but President Trump isn't letting up. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Trump administration says it will cut about 20,000 workers at the Department of Health and Human Services. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports officials plan to restructure the agency and even combine units.
It looks like the steepest cuts are coming from CDC and FDA. Also, a lesser-known agency called the Administration for Community Living, which helps seniors and people with disabilities live independently. They do work like meal delivery, transportation support for caregivers. Under the plans, that agency will be dismantled and its, quote, critical services will get spread out over a few different agencies.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reporting. European leaders say that sanctions against Russia must be strengthened as the Kremlin's war in Ukraine continues. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is warning Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to divide Europe and America.
Meeting in Paris, the leaders of more than two dozen European, NATO, and other nations also discussed a reassurance force for Ukraine after a truce. While not every nation will commit troops, there's unanimity that sanctions against Russia cannot be scaled back. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said increasing sanctions is the way to bring Russia to the negotiating table, and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said lifting them would be a grave mistake and make no sense without a truce. Ukraine's top general says Russian troops are increasing their attacks in an attempt to enter Ukraine's Sumy region, which borders Russia's Kursk region. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kramatorsk.
The Israeli military says that it has targeted suburban Beirut today. This happened after rockets were fired from that area toward northern Israel. The militant group Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, denies that it fired the rockets. Hezbollah says it remains committed to a ceasefire. Israeli officials say they have told Lebanese civilians to evacuate. There are reports of Lebanese civilians in panic. One of the targeted areas includes two schools. This is NPR. A federal judge has ordered several Trump administration officials to save text messages that included military plans to attack sites in Yemen recently. A watchdog group has sued to preserve the messages so they won't be deleted. The Trump administration is claiming that information is not classified. President Trump has signed an executive order to rid the Smithsonian Institution of what he claims is divisive, race-centered ideology. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the order accuses the Biden administration of seeking to revise historical truth.
Titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, the order states, quote, museums in our nation's capital should be places where individuals go to learn, not to be subjected to ideological indoctrination or divisive narratives that distort our shared history. The order states that the Smithsonian will no longer receive federal funding for programs and exhibitions that have racial components. It also requests that future appropriations for the American Women's History Museum, quote, celebrate the achievements of women and do not recognize men as women in any respect. The Smithsonian did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Wildfires continue to burn in the Carolinas. Officials in North Carolina say the Black Cove wildfire burning in the western part of that state has now been designated as the highest priority wildfire burning in the U.S. The weather is very dry and winds are strong there. There are also enormous numbers of dead trees blown down during Hurricane Helene. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear about how a new executive order from the president could affect the Smithsonian. But first, we want to talk about President Trump's plan to impose a 25% tariff on imported cars and car parts next week. Unionized auto workers are cheering, but investors who own stock in automakers are less enthusiastic. And people who want to buy a new car might have to pay thousands of dollars more. NPR's Scott Horsley has been watching reaction to the president's tariff announcement this week, and he's with us now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Michelle.
So President Trump says adding a tax on imported cars and car parts will encourage automakers to build more vehicles here in the United States. Is that likely?
You know, it's possible. That's why members of the UAW are excited about this proposal, even though the union did not support President Trump in last year's election. UAW President Sean Fain notes there is extra capacity at U.S. auto plants if automakers wanted to move jobs out of Mexico or other countries and get around this 25% tariff. But it's not a slam dunk that's going to happen. You know, it took decades to build the North American auto supply network. And Carl Brower, who's an analyst at the shopping site IC Cars, says automakers aren't going to unwind that overnight.
This is an industry that doesn't operate on a weekly or monthly or even yearly time frame. It operates on a half a decade or more time frame.
Of the big three Detroit automakers, General Motors is the most dependent on imported vehicles. GM CEO Mary Barra said a couple months ago her company was not going to spend a lot of money to relocate jobs unless she got some clarity about what the tariff landscape was going to look like. And given the roller coaster we've seen with the president's trade policy over the last few weeks, I'm not sure how big a bet anyone's going to want to place just yet.
And I think I saw that GM stock took a beating yesterday. Am I right about that?
Yeah, all the automaker shares suffered, but GM's took the biggest hit, down more than 7%. Nearly half the cars sold in the U.S. are imported, and the half that are assembled here typically contain some imported parts. So most automakers have at least some exposure to these tariffs. Tesla, the electric car maker led by Elon Musk, relies primarily on American-made parts. Its shares actually went up a little bit on the tariff news.
So President Trump has also said that these tariffs will raise a lot of money for the government. How realistic is that?
The White House estimates these auto tariffs would generate about $100 billion a year for the government, and Republicans are counting on that to help offset the cost of the president's tax cuts. But here's the thing. The U.S. only gets that tariff revenue if automakers continue producing cars and parts in foreign countries. If production actually did shift back to the U.S., there'd be no tariff. Tariffs can either bring jobs home or they can raise revenue, but the more they do of the one, the less they can do of the other.
Okay, let's talk about consumers now. For people who are in the market for a new car right now, what should they expect?
They should probably expect to pay more, unless they get out this weekend and make a deal before these tariffs take effect. Most cars sold in the U.S. are going to face some tariff expense, and Brower says that's going to mean higher prices.
There's really no way the cost of producing any vehicle sold in the U.S. doesn't go up from this. The only variable is how much of that gets passed on to the consumer.
Tariffs are likely to add thousands of dollars to the cost of a typical new car. For some people, that'll be a deal breaker. They might buy a used car, so used car prices could also go up. None of this is helpful when it comes to curbing inflation, which the president likes to say is a big reason he got elected.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump says auto tariffs will bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. Our next guest has some doubts. Jim Ross is the mayor of Arlington, Texas, which is home to a large General Motors auto assembly plant. Mayor Ross, what is your perspective on the president's tariff plan?
Well, we have the General Motors assembly plant here in Arlington that manufactures all of the SUVs made by General Motors. So it's an Escalade, Tahoe, Suburban, whatever. It's made here in Arlington. That plant employs about 5,600 employees. And we're concerned about the livelihood of those employees. If the tariffs go into effect, if consumers are paying more money, are they going to be buying less vehicles now? And if they are, how is that going to affect the employees at the assembly plant? So we've written a letter to the two senators here in Texas, Senator Cornyn and Senator Cruz, to ask them to help intervene on behalf of the automotive industry here in Texas. We have yet to hear a response from them, but hopefully we're going to get through this crisis and come out better at the other end.
Yeah, that was what earlier this month you sent that letter along with the mayor of San Antonio. I'm wondering if maybe, because I read that you said that you don't know how tariffs will benefit any Texans. So I'm wondering if maybe you've also reached out to the Trump administration to try and explain how this will benefit people in Texas.
Well, we haven't reached out to the Trump administration directly. I'm a part of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and the mayors of the U.S. Conference has certainly reached out to the Trump administration. We've yet to get a meeting with the Trump administration on this. I know that the U.S. Conference of Mayors, along with mayors in Canada and mayors in Mexico, are meeting next month to discuss tariffs and see what we can do as collective mayors in all three countries to work together like we have done for decades and decades.
You've called this a job-killing threat. What do you envision as the worst-case scenario come April 2nd?
You know, April 2nd, worst-case scenario, the bottom line is consumers are going to be paying for tariffs. And if consumers are paying for tariffs and they can no longer afford vehicles, that means a decrease in the amount of production at our assembly plant, and that is where we're concerned about it being a job-killing threat. If this does ultimately create more jobs, those jobs aren't going to happen overnight. We've spent decades building these plants and getting these things going. General Motors have been here for 60, 70 years. It's going to take a long time for us to see any benefit from this whatsoever. In the meantime, people are going to be paying the price. Mexico's not paying the price. Canada's not paying the price. It is the people here in the United States paying the price.
You mentioned the over 5,000 workers at the General Motors plant. Are you worried that people will move, will leave Arlington, and maybe also affect some of the other businesses that are around the plant, like, say, a diner or a clothing store or something like that?
Listen, we have a lot of businesses that rely upon our General Motors employees. But we also have the vendor type businesses that supply all kinds of parts and materials to the assembly plant. When a vehicle is manufactured, we're not just talking about manufacturing a vehicle from outside the country and bringing it in. We have different components within that vehicle that are manufactured all over the world and brought into the United States. Some are then shipped back and other assembly is done and then brought back. You're talking potentially being able to tariff parts of a vehicle two or three times. That's going to be a tremendous expense that the end consumer is going to be using.
Mayor, I know that mayoral elections in Arlington are nonpartisan, but Arlington is in the 25th congressional district, one that overwhelmingly voted for President Trump. Do residents in Arlington in this district share your concerns about tariffs?
Yeah, they do. You know, I'm very proud of our community. We lie right in the middle of Dallas and Fort Worth. I'd say we're a purple community. We don't consider ourselves blue or red. We just want our streets fixed, our community safe, our citizens to stay employed. And that's what citizens here in Arlington are concerned about. I don't take a position when it comes to national politics, pro or con, one side or the other. I believe that politicians have a duty to do what's best for the community, whether it's a local community like Arlington, the state of Texas, or the federal government.
Mayor, this show is heard in D.C., where there are plenty of congresspeople there. You have about 30 seconds to speak to them to try and get some security for your city and for the jobs there.
You know, if I could speak to them directly, I would say, y'all, stop attacking the other side, one way or the other. I don't care about that, or the community doesn't care about that, and start doing what's best for the communities as a whole. We don't want to hear blame placed on everybody else. We want people to do their job.
That's Mayor Jim Ross of Arlington, Texas. Mayor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Y'all have a great day.
President Trump signed an executive order yesterday directing Vice President J.D. Vance to eliminate, quote, divisive race-centered ideology, unquote, from the Smithsonian Institution, educational and research centers, and the National Zoo. NPR's Chloe Veltman says the order blames the Biden administration for seeking to revise what their successors consider historical truth.
In a public talk just last Sunday about the Smithsonian American Art Museum's achievements and upcoming plans, acting director Jane Carpenter Rock said this.
Given our location here in the nation's capital, with significant levels of federal funding, we are also mindful of the rapid changes swirling around us in the federal government. And we are right now still navigating the impact they will have on the Smithsonian.
Now there's a lot more navigating to be done. A show at the American Art Museum, The Shape of Power, Stories of Race and American Sculpture, is specifically called out in President Trump's latest executive order for promoting, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. Among other stipulations, the order seeks to prohibit the Smithsonian from receiving funding for programs and exhibitions that, quote, degrade shared American values and divide Americans based on race, and to restore monuments and statues that have been removed from public spaces in recent years in response to growing calls to address racial injustice and the legacy of slavery. This is the latest in a series of recent White House executive orders aimed at rolling back diversity efforts. The Smithsonian Institution closed its diversity office in January. NPR reached out to the Smithsonian, several board members, and members of the museum and academic communities for comment, but received no immediate responses. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. The new film The Friend, starring Bill Murray and Naomi Watts, was adapted from a novel by Sigrid Nunez. It's about a woman writer who reluctantly inherits a 180-pound Great Dane after his owner, her friend and former mentor, dies by suicide. Like her, the dog is grieving. We'll hear my interview with Nunez about the book. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach, now playing in theaters. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. How many albums are so good you wouldn't skip a single track? One of today's greatest ambassadors of jazz, Branford Marsalis, fell in love with an album Keith Jarrett made in 1974 with three Scandinavian sidemen. It was called Belonging. Branford Marsalis is taking that appreciation next level. His quartet just released a reinterpretation of every piece from that album.
I figured out when I was 14 years old playing in a cover band is that it's amazing how much better your music can be if you spend your time listening to and stealing from people who are better at it than you are.
I had to chuckle when I read some of the notes that came with the album, where you mentioned how you got into Keith Jarrett's music. Yeah. I had that same kind of eureka feeling that you had, because I remember a friend introduced me to Keith Jarrett, and I was like, wait, how come I don't know about this? Like, what's happening here? Yeah. So could you just tell that story, if you wouldn't mind, about how you got into Keith Jarrett?
Oh, yeah. He made a record called The Kong Concerts that I wasn't particularly fond of. And my pianist at the time and my dear friend Kenny Kirkland said, man, you need to check Keith out. At that time in my life, I embraced that stupid adage, first impressions are lasting impressions. And my mind was made up, and then he slipped the headphones on my head on a plane. And I started listening, and I'm like, who is this? Oh, it must be Keith Jarrett, because he's been selling it. Man, this is pretty good. And then when he reached to take the headphones back, I covered my hands over the headphones and didn't allow him to. And he just started to laugh. He says, man, that's what you get for being stubborn. I told you. And I bought all of that stuff.
So tell me a bit about how you and the quartet went about it. You clearly didn't sit there and transcribe pieces from the album. Number one, this is jazz, so that's not going to happen. But the tracks...
Don't kid yourself. That happens all the time.
Does it? Okay. Well, I stand corrected.
There's a cottage industry out there with literal solos being worked out and regurgitated and still called improvisation.
Oh,
but
dear.
I digress.
Oh, dear. Okay. But these are not note for note the originals. They are definitely... You and the quartet, you're doing your thing.
Yeah, well, we have a different sonic perspective than those guys would have had in 1974. I grew up in New Orleans and grew up singing songs and clanging pencils on a fence, singing two-way pocky way. The guys in his band are clearly great musicians, but I feel comfortable in saying that some Norwegian guys born in the 1940s, weren't in a Southern University type marching band and didn't grow up listening to R&B with the regularity that we did. So we have all these sonic perspectives that we can bring to the music, so we don't have to spend much time trying to alter or change the original songs or the construction of the songs, because how we interpret those songs will be automatically different than the way that they would interpret them.
So let's listen to an example. I'm just going to play one of my favorites, the Keith Jarrett piece, The Wind Up, fun piece. Let's play a little bit of the original. Okay, now let's play some of my new favorite. This is your version of The Wind Up. Feel the New Orleans.
Yeah.
Am I right?
And the drummer's from Philly. That's what's okay. Wild about it. But he spent 2 months in New Orleans working on a film because he said, oh, man, you're always bragging about your raggedy-ass city. Well, I'm going to go live down there for 2 months. And 2 weeks into it, he's like, this is the most amazing city in the world. I said, well, in America for sure. I don't know about the world, but he loved it and he learned a lot of stuff. And when we play certain songs, it does have that kind of New Orleans romp feel to it. Piano player Joey. Joey's from New Rochelle, New York, and lives in Durham, North Carolina. Eric Rivas is from Fresno, but he lives in Los Angeles. But he did live in New Orleans for 2 years. So all the little New Orleans cues, I mean, those two guys know him for sure. So like at towards the end of the song in the middle, we have this song called The Second Line, and the trumpet player plays this phrase, da-da-ba-da, and everybody has to go, hey!
Yes!
And I played it, and they said it. It wasn't one of those things where I scripted and said, okay, guys, when I play this lick, you guys say, hey, it was instinctive. They just went there.
I love it. Had you ever had a chance to work with Keith Jarrett?
No, I've never even met Keith.
Oh, wow.
People say, oh, do you think that's strange? I say, well, I haven't met Thelonious Monk either. Or Charlie Parker or Beethoven. But I still listen to the music and I still study things. The songs are hard to play. I will say that. I'm glad I didn't try to do this 15 years ago. I think we would have failed, or it just wouldn't have been very good. We would have succeeded to a degree, but the songs have beautiful melodies and great emotional depth, and you have to be a mature musician to grasp the emotion in each song and tailor the sound of your instruments and of your group to reproduce the emotion that's required. But for us, I mean, we've been dealing with all these different styles and strains of music since this particular iteration that the band started in 2009. So we didn't have to talk it through. We just had to play it.
That is Branford Marsalis. His quartet just released a reinterpretation of Keith Jarrett's 1974 album, Belonging. Branford Marsalis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. It was a pleasure to talk with you again.
This is NPR News.
President Trump's cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has some scallop fishermen facing stricter regulations on their catching limits.
Some are welcoming the cuts, saying that the government has been their downfall. There's too many regulations, and I don't share that opinion.
We'll talk smaller scallop catches at the dock on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
Vice President Vance and his wife are visiting a U.S. military base in Greenland today. The Danish territory has gotten a lot of attention in recent months, with President Trump repeatedly suggesting the U.S. gain control of Greenland, citing its vast minerals and strategic importance. In Moscow, NPR's Charles Main says Russian President Vladimir Putin is giving something of an endorsement to Trump's idea.
Speaking at a forum in the Arctic port city of Murmansk, Putin extolled on the U.S.'s historical links to Greenland. The Kremlin leader noted that the U.S. first tried to win control over the territory in the 19th century and then again after World War II. Putin said it was obvious the Trump White House was advancing its strategic interests in the Arctic and made clear Russia would not stand in Trump's way. While the Kremlin has expressed intense concern over the growing military competition between Russia and NATO in the Arctic, it's been more sympathetic to Trump's bid to control Greenland. Kremlin critics say Putin sees the move as helping justify Moscow's own historical and security interests in Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
At least three deaths are reported in Bangkok today following a strong earthquake that shook Myanmar and Thailand. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake had a magnitude of 7.7 and struck central Myanmar not long after midday. This is NPR News. Crews in the Carolinas continue battling wildfires amid dry conditions. The National Weather Service has issued red flag warnings again in western North Carolina and northwestern South Carolina. The governor of Montana has signed two bills into law restricting transgender people's access to public accommodations and school sports. Shaylee Rager with Montana Public Radio has more.
Republican Governor Greg Gianforte signed a law requiring transgender people to use public accommodations, like bathrooms, according to their reproductive anatomy. Public entities are civilly liable for enforcing the law, effective immediately. The ACLU of Montana filed an emergency request for a judge to block the law. The filing argues the policy is discriminatory and violates the state's right to privacy. Gianforte also signed a law prohibiting schools from allowing transgender athletes to participate on girls' and women's sports teams to take effect in July. Montana previously banned transgender students' participation in sports under a 2021 law, but it was struck down. For NPR News, I'm Shaylee Rager in Helena.
The latest numbers on consumer prices show inflation remains an issue for the U.S. economy. The Commerce Department says prices in February were up 2.5% compared to the same month 1 year ago. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 123 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Howard University, the historically black school here, opens a center today dedicated to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution after the Civil War. It establishes that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are American citizens, entitled to equal protection and due process under the law. Sherilyn Eiffel will lead the center. She holds the Verdon E. Jordan Jr.
Jr. Esquire Chair in Civil Rights at Howard's Law School and is the former president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I started our conversation by asking her to describe the goal of the program.
We are, after all, at a law school and try to be supportive of litigation brought by others, but we will not be bringing litigation ourselves. But it is really more of a space for research, for scholarship, for curriculum development, and for convening people together across disciplines to talk about the values of the 14th Amendment and to think through how to infuse those values into the various institutions of American life and into our educational institutions most of all.
One of the reasons people who aren't lawyers might recognize the 14th Amendment is that it establishes birthright citizenship.
Yeah.
And one of the executive orders that President Trump signed on his first day in office was an attempt to nullify it. But is part of the purpose of the center to weigh in on this discussion in some way, since this has been surfaced in this new era?
Yeah, it's very important. And in fact, you know, the 14th Amendment touches the life of every single person in this country, and they don't realize it. And birthright citizenship is just one of those ways. Birthright citizenship was created to overturn the Dred Scott decision, in which the Supreme Court had said that black people, whether they were enslaved or free, could not be citizens of this country. And so obviously black people are incredibly affected by birthright citizenship as well. But if you think about the waves of immigrants that have come from across the world to the United States with the understanding and the knowledge that they could become naturalized citizens, that their children, if born the day after they arrived in this country, will be citizens of this country, it gives you a sense of the reach and touch of the 14th Amendment.
What is your hope for the work of the center and how it will touch people who are not going to go to Howard Law School?
There are people all over this country who will proudly and passionately tell you about their Second Amendment rights. But when was the last time you heard somebody, an ordinary American, tell you about their 14th Amendment rights, even though those are the rights that guarantee equality in this country, that ensure that the state cannot take things from you without providing you with some due process, and that guarantee birthright citizenship? And the point of the center is to create the kind of curriculum, both formal and informal, and the kind of narrative that Americans can get their hands around so that they will come to cloak their conception of these rights that we take for granted in constitutional terms.
Before we let you go, the other thing that the 14th Amendment stipulates is that no one who's engaged in insurrection can hold high office in the United States. And I do wonder whether any of your scholarly work will be addressing that point, that part of the amendment.
Well, indeed. And of course, the Supreme Court issued a decision last year. We did file an amicus brief in that case last year, Trump versus Anderson. There are other provisions of the 14th Amendment that I want to explore as part of the work of this center. It is the longest amendment to the Constitution. So the part you read at the very beginning is the part that all law students learn. But even most law students didn't learn about Section 3, the insurrection clause. And most law students don't learn about Section 2, which purports to reduce the representation of states that engage in voter suppression. And so it really is a sleeping giant. And part of the purpose of this center is to fully familiarize Americans with the richness of this important constitutional amendment. And that would include all of its provisions that I think are quite relevant for the challenges that we face today.
That's Sherrilyn Ifill. She's a professor at Howard University's Law School. Professor Ifill, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
Democratic voters upset over President Trump's spending cuts are also angry at their own party for what they say is too weak of a response. KQED's Guy Marzorati takes us to a town hall in California.
Ayla Ozturk showed up to a community center in Bakersfield earlier this week to make her voice heard about the Trump administration's efforts to slash spending.
They're just looking totally in the wrong places.
She's upset about potential cuts in the future to health care programs like Medicaid.
All of these areas that are just being like cut and have been like neglected, and it makes me very angry.
Ozturk is mad at her own party for not doing more in the face of these cuts proposed by congressional Republicans.
People just want to see the Democratic Party just like do something.
California Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna organized these town halls hundreds of miles south from his Bay Area home. This one in a key swing district held by Republican Rep. David Valadao. Khanna came here to rally voters in Valadao's Central Valley district, where two-thirds of residents are on Medicaid, the most of any seat in California.
We need that organizing today
to save Medicaid and to save our democracy.
But many of the locals who came up to the open mic were Democrats wanting to get their own house in order.
We need more direction, I feel, from the Democratic Party.
Our leaders have done some serious damage to the party.
So what are the Democrats doing?
When is the Democratic Party going to set aside its peacetime leaders and bring up some wartime leaders? Because that's what we need.
Speakers were especially unhappy about Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer's recent decision to avert a government shutdown by supporting a Republican spending bill. Khanna criticized Schumer and called for new leadership in the party, which won the approval of Bakersfield resident Mitch Carrillo.
They were mentioning the old guard in the Democratic Party, and they've done some really great things, but it's time to step aside and let's let this younger generation come in and see what they can do.
In Carrillo's mind, this moment calls for a different energy.
Because the Republicans aren't playing fair, they're not playing by the rule book.
Whatever
it takes to win, they'll do. And so the Democrats don't have an answer for that.
California Democratic strategist Orrin Evans says for now, the anger at town halls is focused more on the party's posture, not its platform.
No one is showing up at these things screaming that we need to be more to the left on any one particular policy. It's where's the backbone? Let's fight.
Shoykat Chakrabarty is the former chief of staff to Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In an interview with KQED, he says this desire to fight should morph into challenges to Democratic incumbents.
I really think we need dozens, not hundreds of people to take over the party. Due to the Democratic Party, what Trump did to Republicans, but not around a cult of personality, you know? We need a whole movement to do it.
And he agrees that movement is not necessarily about moving policy to the left.
I think it's a movement of people who actually want to act, who want to fight, and who want to go bigger and bolder, and who want to actually solve health care and actually get all this stuff built.
Chakrabarty is hoping to be part of that movement. He's mounting a run for Congress next year in the San Francisco seat held by Nancy Pelosi. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati.
This is NPR News.
President Trump wants to make Canada the 51st state. It's not the first time that Americans have had hungry eyes for our northern neighbor. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. A miniature dachshund named Valerie has stayed alive all alone for 16 months in a place called Kangaroo Island in Australia. Seems she got out of her playpen, ran into the bush. A few months later, a wiener dog wearing a pink collar matching her description was spotted on camera. People think she's had to toughen up by eating roadkill and dodging venomous snakes. Seriously, the script for this animated movie version of this story is writing itself. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. For decades, the World Trade Organization refereed global trade disputes until it was sidelined by the U.S. So, in the midst of a new trade war, Weilin Wong and Adrian Ma of The Indicator from Planet Money explain why Washington has turned its back on an organization it helped create.
After World War II, powerful countries like the U.S. and the United Kingdom got together to set up the new ground rules for the global economy.
These post-war arrangements culminated in the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995. It's basically a big club of countries that agree to trade with each other using the same set of rules.
When governments get into disputes over these rules, they go to the WTO, and here's how that process works. First, the case gets heard by a panel of experts. They make a ruling.
And then the governments can appeal that decision to a different panel of experts. This group is known as the appellate body.
Jennifer Hillman is a professor at the Georgetown Law Center, and she served on the appellate body from 2007 to early 2012.
You basically have to be ready to drop everything the minute you are put onto an appeal, fly to Geneva, and then the work is quite intense.
Intense, like 70 to 80 hour weeks. The panel has around just a couple of months to make a decision. And this ruling, by the way, is final.
And if at the end of the day, the appellate body says there was a violation, then what it does is recommend that the country bring its measure into compliance. In other words, fix the problem.
Fixing the problem might mean reducing tariffs on specific products or lifting a ban on certain kinds of imports. And for a while, the system of settling disputes worked. Jennifer says countries would generally follow the WTO rulings, even the U.S.
And the U.S. did lose at the WTO. Like several years ago, the state of Washington had to end a preferential tax rate for aerospace manufacturing. This came out of a long-running dispute between the U.S. and the EU over subsidies to companies like Boeing and Airbus.
Quinn Slobodian is a professor of international history at Boston University. He points out that when it helped found the WTO, the U.S. signed onto a system where it wouldn't always get its way.
It was a moment where America, the world's most powerful country, saw it somehow in its own interest to cede part of their sovereignty to this international institution.
However, the U.S. would eventually grow unhappy with the WTO. Quinn says a big factor here is China, which joined the group in 2001 and became an economic powerhouse. And yeah, China was part of the same economic club, but it was also claiming exemptions from free trade rules on the basis of it being a developing country. Jennifer says these frustrations came to a head during the Obama administration. And so the U.S. blocked the reappointment of some members to the WTO appeals panel. Then, during the first Trump administration, the U.S. started blocking all new appointments to the appellate body. In late 2019, the group stopped functioning because it didn't have enough members.
This paralysis continued through the Biden administration, although it had been in talks on reforming the WTO appeals panel. That work didn't get done before Biden left office.
Where does this leave other countries? Well, historian Quinn Slobodian says governments have been busy making trade deals without the U.S. In fact, Quinn says he thinks the future of international cooperation looks more like this, a bunch of regional agreements.
Weilin Wong,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Today we have a story of immigration and a family's journey across three continents as told by a 10-year-old. Ameya Desai is one of the fourth grade winners in NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. NPR's Janet Ujung Lee brings us her story and her winning entry.
When Ameya Desai started elementary school, she would pester her dad every morning on their drive to class.
Daddy, you owe me a story. Yeah. Like, Daddy, you owe me a story. And then when I was like, what for? I'm like, because I'm your daughter. Yeah. You have to tell me a story.
So her dad, Nikhil Desai, came up with a series of stories with original characters. One of them followed an ancient warrior who's on a quest to find her real family. Over time, he made up sequels, then prequels.
So what happens is when I drop her off to school, I'll say, to be continued. And I think the story is still going. We never really finished the story, right? I think it's still ongoing. Yeah.
Years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
The father-daughter duo sit next to each other at the dining table at their home in San Jose, California. They constantly exchange eye contact and loving giggles throughout dinner.
That's my daughter to a T. You know, she loves stories.
So it's no surprise that Ameya, at a very young age, wanted to tell some of her own.
Hi, I'm Ameya Desai, and you are listening to Far From Home, a story of forced migration.
In her award-winning podcast, Ameya interviews her grandfather, Kishore Desai, who was born in Uganda.
Sugarcane fields stretch for miles all around as far as the eyes can see.
Kishore's parents had migrated from India, and his father worked at a sugarcane factory outside of Uganda's capital, Kampala.
We used to play a lot of sports by the side of sugarcane fields, and anytime one was hungry or thirsty, we just broke a sugarcane and chewed on it for instant sugar rush.
But Kishore's life was completely turned around when he was in college. In the summer of 1972, Uganda's leader Idi Amin ordered the mass expulsion of Asians from the country.
Idi Amin gave the Indians 90 days to leave Uganda. My grandfather's life changed forever.
I was in shock and disbelief. My family, once intact, was dispersed all over the world. We were never a single family unit again.
Kishore was stateless for years while he finished his studies. He then migrated to the United States, where he had to start all over again.
My friends and I want to be that generation that keeps talking about the stories of displacement, like my grandfather's, that don't get told often enough. I think when we share the pain and suffering of our history, we can ensure it doesn't happen to others.
Back at the dining room table, Ameya and her dad call grandfather Kishore.
Hi, Nikhil.
Hey, Dad.
They ask how listening to the podcast made him feel.
Totally taken aback, you know.
Nikhil says he too learned new details about his father's life.
Were it not for you and for the thing that you went through and the sacrifice that you made, I would not be here. Your granddaughter would not be here.
Thank you, Dada.
Hi, Ameya. You're welcome.
Bye.
What is the next project? I hope it doesn't involve me now.
And a funny thing happened when Ameya was announced one of the winners of the podcast challenge. Other people came forward wanting to share their stories with her.
Are you ready, Miss Ameya?
When we visited Williams Elementary School, Ameya was presenting her fifth grade research project. The topic she chose? The internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War.
I interviewed Miss Linda Horikawa, a child who lived in the internment camps.
Her neighbor told Ameya stories from 80 years ago that she'd mostly kept to herself. Stories of her family being forced to leave their home.
Miss Linda said, my father carried a crib in each arm for me and my sister. We never knew where we would be going and if we would even have a bed.
Ameya's turning her interview with Miss Horikawa into her next podcast episode.
I worry this part of history will disappear when this generation is gone. It's important that we learn about the people who have lived through the experiences of war, not necessarily at the battlefield, but here at home.
Like any good journalist, Ameya's looking at the world around her for more stories.
Because that just kind of lit up a spark in me. You should always listen to that spark, because that means you're doing the right thing.
Advice from award-winning journalist Ameya Desai. If a story makes you feel something, don't just sit there. Do something about it. Janet Ujung Lee, NPR News, San Jose, California.
Rick Hubbard has been chasing a musical dream for 20 years. That's how long he's been trying to put together the world's largest kazoo ensemble as certified by the Guinness Book of World Records. Hubbard will try again today during the Cherry Blossom Festival in Macon, Georgia. And as Grant Blankenship of Georgia Public Broadcasting reports, he is actively recruiting.
Ready? Here we go.
Rick Hubbard is in a room full of kids, third graders, with kazoos. He has no fear.
I am the king of kazoo. Hey, everybody stop.
He got on this path in 1987. Hubbard was a musician in a beach resort town, guitar mostly. Someone told him to make his act appeal to kids. The kazoo did the trick.
I'm the only professional kazoo player to ever play at the Kennedy Center.
So, king of kazoo. And the record for the most people playing kazoo for 5 minutes straight is 5,190, set in London in 2011.
And ever since the record in London came, we were like, no, we have to get this record back. It's called Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
All Hubbard needs is 5,200, just 10 more kazooists to set the record in Macon.
All right, we're not going to do the whole thing. It's 45 minutes.
And so he's trying to get these kids, maybe their whole families, to come out and help.
This is your white whale.
This is. It's my Moby Dick.
And Rick Hubbard hopes.
For our grand finale.
His legacy.
We're going to play a marching song. So I want everybody to stand up. Someday in the future, when they write my obituary, they'll be able to say, Rick Hubbard, comma, leader of the world's largest kazoo band, comma, passed away today. At least there'll be something.
As for his chances of breaking the London record,
it'll be my claim to fame if we can do it. If not, hey, let me hear you guys play it all together now. At least we tried.
Rick Hubbard hopes lots of people will try with him on Friday afternoon, and you don't even need to bring your own kazoo. Hubbard brought about 10,000. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
All right, kick it up a notch. Play it loud now.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.